4. Inside Hiro's suit, Cordyceps novus found what it had been looking for. A tiny scratch in the surface of Hiro's calf. Even an overwide pore opening would have been big enough for it to gain entry into her bloodstream, but the open scratch, which cut through two layers of her skin, fairly yawned with possibility. Hiro didn't even know she had an open wound. It had been an absent-minded scratch. She was reacting to an itch produced by a changed cleaning product. The hotel that washed her jeans last week had used a cheap optical brightener with a higher concentration of bleach than she was used to, so it itched, and she scratched. And the fungus entered her bloodstream. "What's that smell?" Hiro asked. They were 50 yards from the jeep. Roberto looked at her. "What smell?" She sniffed again. "Burnt toast?" Trini shrugged. "Can't smell anything." She looked back, glad to leave the town behind. This whole place is going to smell like burnt toast by the end of the day. But Roberto was confused, still looking at Hiro. "In your suit?" Hiro held up an arm and regarded it, as if reminding herself she was wearing a sealed biohazard suit. "That doesn't make sense, does it?" In fact, it made perfect sense. Cordyceps novus was really warming up and had superheated the starches and proteins just inside Hiro's epidermis. As a byproduct of the reaction, they outgassed acrylamide, producing the same smell as burnt toast. It was generating heat as well, and the sudden rise in temperature on Hiro's skin would surely bother her soon. But the fungus was attentive to that possibility and was moving fast through her bloodstream, racing to get to her brain, where it would intercept the messages from her pain receptors. This in itself was no great trick. A tick does the same thing, releasing a surface anesthetic as soon as it burrows into its victim's skin so its blood-sucking can go unnoticed for as long as possible. But the fungus had a long way to travel and a lot of receptors to block. Hiro's heartbeat accelerated, which circulated her blood faster, inadvertently helping her would-be killer. She stopped walking. "There can't be a smell in my suit. It's sealed and overpressured. There's nothing in here but oxygen and clean CO2. Why is there a smell in my suit?" She was starting to panic. Trini tried to defuse it. "There are probably a lot of jokes I could make here." "It's not fucking funny," Hiro snapped. "It's not, Trini. Shut the hell up. Something penetrated her suit." "That's not possible," Hiro said, to convince herself as much as anyone else. "Just keep moving," Trini advised. "We'll lose the suits of the jeep. We can't take them out of here anyway. They need to burn. We'll check yours for breaches." She looked at Hiro, her manner serious. "Do you feel anything?" Hiro thought. "No," Roberto persisted. "Take a minute, focus on each part of your body. Anything different at all?" Hiro's breathing steadied. She considered the question, going through her anatomy from the bottoms of her feet to the top of her head. "No, nothing different." Inside her body, it was a different story. The fungus had penetrated Hiro's brain and was reproducing at nightmare speed, seeking out and blocking her nociceptors the way an invading army shuts down the internet and television stations. There was a red alert blaring in Hiro's brain. Flags were waving, alarm bells ringing, but the ends of her sensory neurons' axons had been taken over and blocked from responding to damaging stimuli. They could no longer send potential threat messages to her thalamus and subcortical areas. They were screaming into a void. Hiro Martins was dying. But the neural message she got from her brain was that everything was fine. Just fine. Don't worry about a thing. "I'm okay." "You're sure?" Roberto asked. She nodded. "Let's just get out of here." They started walking again, now 40 yards from the jeep. Hiro's brain thought through possible reasons a foreign smell should have presented itself inside her suit. Nothing believable came to mind. She decided she would not destroy this suit. She was going to tank and return it. She wanted to have a chance to take it apart and look at every inch of it, in case there was a tear or foreign substance inside, in which case somebody in PPE was going to get an earful about procedure. The jeep was now 30 yards away. Hiro felt lightheaded and realized she hadn't eaten since 9 or 10 hours ago. Then again, looking at Uncle's mutilated corpse wouldn't exactly stimulate anyone's appetite, so there was no reason to think anything unusual about that. She ran through her physical inventory once again, but other than elevated heart rate and some quickened breathing, there wasn't anything physically different about her that she could detect. She squinted up at the sun, and as she did, a thought floated through her mind. Except there's no telephone service out here. Well, no, there wasn't. What did that matter? She looked down at the case in her hand, thinking about what she had inside the tube. People were going to lose their minds over this one. She wondered if the CDC would even accept it. So there's no telephone poles. She shook her head to clear it and resumed her train of thought. There were only a handful of labs in the Western Hemisphere that were set up to store biosafety level 4 pathogens, and Atlanta and Galveston would reject it outright, improperly classifying it as extraterrestrial because of its trip outside Earth's atmosphere. Maybe an electrical tower. The U.S. Army would fight for it, no question about that, but Fort Detrick had suffered a breach 18 months ago and no one was eager to. They've got to have power, right? Don't they have power? She snapped her head to the side. Come on, focus. They were 10 yards from the Jeep. Her image of it suddenly shuddered and divided into 16 identical rectangular boxes, 16 images of the Jeep neatly separated and replicated. Hero felt her skin go cold, because that wasn't something you could easily ignore or pass off to hunger or exhaustion. But then again, she thought, I used to faint when I was a kid, in school assemblies sometimes, and didn't it feel like this? Wasn't there a prickling in her scalp and then her vision would go weird and she'd see double right before she keeled over? Sure, that was probably it, low blood sugar, a radio tower, 50 kilometers back. Didn't I see something? Wasn't it a radio tower? The image swam through her mind, crisp and clear. They had driven past a radio tower in the middle of the desert, just alongside the road, about 100 meters high, with a small black utility box at the base of it. That's exactly what it was. She said that last bit out loud, and Roberto and Trini turned and looked at her. What? Roberto asked. She looked at him. Huh? That's exactly what was. Hero had no idea what he was talking about. Was it possible that Roberto had somehow become infected by the fungus? That it was his suit that had malfunctioned? And that he was starting to lose his mind? She certainly hoped not. He was a nice enough guy, even if he was a total flirt. She really had to lay off the married men. Never again, she vowed, right there and then. From now on, either find someone appropriate or be content with, it can't be that hard to climb. Oh, shit. She had to think this through. To climb. The radio tower. It had lateral struts about 4 or 5 feet apart, but there's probably a service ladder inside the structure. How else would they repair anything that broke near the top of the thing? I could climb that. For the last time, the weight and pressure of the healthy, functioning neurons in Hero's brain outweighed those that had been consumed, destroyed, or shut down by Cordyceps novus. Her prefrontal cortex, which handled reasoning and sophisticated interpersonal thinking skills, reasserted itself in a burst of clarity and control and told her quite clearly that based on A, her disordered thought processes, B, the smell of burnt toast inside her suit that indicated a foreign contaminant. C, the expressions on the faces of Trini and Roberto, who clearly thought something was wrong with her. And D, her sudden and irrational fixation on the feasibility of climbing a fucking radio tower, for Christ's sake. She had likely been infected by the fungus, and was moments away from coming under the control of a rapidly replicating fungus that constituted an extinction-level threat to the human race. Still walking, she glanced to her right and saw Trini was carrying her handgun loosely at her side as she and Roberto looked back and forth from her to each other, trying to communicate their concern wordlessly rather than over the radio system, which she would be able to hear. Take the Jeep and drive to the tower. Hero walked faster, headed for the Jeep. They led her, happy to fall behind so they could keep an eye on her. Climb the tower. As Hero neared the Jeep, she saw the keys, the sunlight shining off them in the ignition. She felt pulled toward them. Climb the tower. Hero's frontal lobe was in a doomed fight for control. It made up a third of the total volume of her brain, but was now overrun with a florid, healthy colony of Cordyceps novus. Her flag of intellectual independence fell. Still, her conscious thought didn't give up. It merely darted away, blew through the wasteland of her already conquered temporal lobe, and turned in desperation to the last part of her mental apparatus that was still free, her parietal lobe. There, her thought stream was precariously her own, but severely limited. Just math now. Math and analytics, where X equals regeneration of healthy brain tissue, probability is 0 minus X, try recovery rate in event of default. She was pulling up a freshman economics class now, but it was the only scrap of useful knowledge left kicking around unfettered in her head, the only avenue of reasoning left open to her, and it was going to have to do. So, let's try a calculation, shall we? The equation to be formed would need to answer only one question. Could she survive this? Recovery probability, RP, versus loss given default, LGD, RP less than or greater than LGD, dependent on instrument type, where instrument type, IT, equals hyper-effective mutating fungus, corporate issues, where corporate issues, CI, equals major default of more than 50% of healthy brain tissue, and prevailing macroeconomic conditions, PMCs, where PMCs equals every single other person who ever encountered this thing is dead. So, RP equals IT over CI times PMC equals... There's no fucking chance whatsoever. The answer was no. She could not recover. She was going to die. The only question was how many people she was going to take with her when she did. Climb the tower, a brain told her. And with the tiny bit of volition Dr. Hero Martin still had left, she replied. No, she said. She turned around fast. Trini didn't have time to react, in part because she was too stunned by the sight of Hiro's swollen, heaving face, which was distended and discolored, the skin stretched so tight it was cracking. Hiro was on her before Trini knew what was happening. She wrenched the gun from Trini's hand. Gun out, Trini shouted, but Roberto had already seen it. He yelled at Hiro to stop, but she was backing away from them already, backing away and turning the gun around on herself. She reached up with her left hand and ripped her suit's Velcro flap over the zippered O2 access port, tore that open, shoved the gun inside the suit, sealed the Velcro flap around the barrel, pressed the barrel of the gun up against her chest. Don't! Roberto yelled, knowing it was too late even as he said it. Hiro pulled the trigger. The bullet broke her skin and crashed through her breastbone, tearing open a hole in her chest the size of a quarter. Like a balloon popped by a pin, the rest of her went all at once, bursting at the sudden release of pressure. All Trini and Roberto saw was her head, which in one moment was a disfigured, although recognizable, human head, and the next moment was a wash of green gunk that completely covered the inside of her faceplate. Hiro fell, dead. But she'd kept her suit intact. Less than 72 hours later, Trini and Roberto were in the car, just over 3 miles away from the Atchison Mines, their eyes glued to the box in the back of the truck just ahead of them. Hiro's field case had been packed, unopened, into a larger sealed crate filled with dry ice. So far, things had gone smoothly. Gordon Gray, the head of the DTRA, had taken Trini and Roberto exactly at their word, because they were the best, and he ordered their explicit instructions be followed to the letter. When Gordon Gray gave an order, people followed it. And since all the residents of the town were dead and the land itself held no value, there was no one and no reason to object. The firebombing of Kirakura was agreed to without debate by the respective governments. The unlucky place burned, and with it, every molecule of Cordyceps novus except for the sample in Hiro's biotube. The question of what to do with the tube was tougher to answer. As Hiro had speculated, the CDC wanted no part of storing something that had been born, or at any rate partially bred, in outer space. Though the Defense Department was willing, its only suitable facility was Fort Detrick, which was out of the question. The breach there 18 months earlier had triggered a top-down review that was only now entering its second stage, and the idea of cutting short a safety analysis in order to store an unknown growth of unprecedented lethality was not met with enthusiasm. Atchison was Trini's idea. She'd worked with the National Nuclear Safety Administration in the early 80s on weapons dismantlement and disposition readiness, as the idea of nuclear disarmament became politically palatable under the Reagan administration's INF Treaty Initiative. Sublevel 4 of the Atchison Mine Facility had been conceived and dug out as an alternative to the Pantex plant and the Y-12 National Security Complex, disposal centers that were at capacity already, dealing with outmoded fission devices from the late 40s and early 50s. But as INF negotiations dragged on, it became clear that Reagan's strategy was really to get the other guy to disarm, and Atchison's lowest sublevel sat empty and secure, never to be used. The location was ideal for their needs. Because the mines were uniquely situated over a second magnitude underground cold spring that pushed near freezing water up from the bedrock at 2,800 liters per second, the lowest subterranean level at Atchison never rose above 38 degrees Fahrenheit. Even in the unlikely event of an extended power outage, the temperature at which the fungus would be stored was guaranteed to remain stable, keeping it in a perpetual low or no growth environment even if it somehow broke free of its containment tube. It was a perfect plan. Cordyceps novus was thus given a home, sealed inside a biotube 300 feet underground in a sub-basement that didn't officially exist. As time went by, fewer and fewer people at DTRA came to share Trini and Roberto's alarmist view of the destructive capabilities of Cordyceps novus. How could they? They hadn't seen it. There were no photographic records. The remote town had been incinerated, and the only remaining sample of the fungus was locked away, out of sight and out of mind. People forgot. People moved on. 16 years later, in 2003, the DTRA decided the mine complex was a Cold War relic that could be dispensed with. The place was cleared out, cleaned up, given a coat of paint, and sold to Smart Warehousing for private use. The self-storage giant threw up some drywall, bought 650 locking overhead garage doors from Horman, and opened it up to the public. 15,000 boxes of useless crap were thus given a clean, dry, and permanent underground home. That 30-year-old drum kit that you never played could now survive a nuclear war. The storage plan for Cordyceps novus was a perfect one, unless, that is, Gordon Gray took early retirement, and his successor decided sublevel 4 was better off sealed up and forgotten. And the temperature of the planet rose. But how likely was any of that?